Well, I do appreciate the gracious invitation so very much to be here with you again this year. I'm grateful for these lectures and what they have meant to the Brotherhood and the cause of Christ, for the videos, the audio tapes, and the books that will be cherished by those who love the truth. And we certainly want to encourage all of the brethren here to keep up the good work, and we do appreciate the efforts that you have put forth to make this possible. When Dub was communicating with me about the assignment, and I mentioned those first seven simple verses, that it boggles my mind how anyone could misunderstand what they say. In that 13th chapter of the book of Romans, he was quick to point out to me that I took everything into consideration and gave you the shortest chapter. And I'm just grateful that Romans 13 didn't have 36 verses in it. I'm thankful that it only has the 14, but certainly it is a challenging study, as is the entire book of Romans. So I'm not going to say that mine is the hardest section this evening, but certainly it is a section that challenges your thinking. And wanting to do what God's will is, of course, causes all of us to think very seriously about all that God has said. Those first seven verses of Romans chapter 13 have been the cause of a great deal of controversy, discussion, and debate, and I know they will continue to be. The powers that be are indeed ordained of God, according to that very first verse. But what responsibilities and obligations does the child of God have to civil government? This is something that we need to consider and think about. Most Christians, I believe, would be willing to affirm that as long as they obey the laws of the land that do not conflict with the laws of God, this is proper and right. It's what God would have them to do. They recognize the duties of both an earthly citizenship and a heavenly citizenship, because we do live in this world, but we know, spiritually speaking, and what we look forward to, our citizenship is indeed in heaven. But there is still a great deal of disagreement as to what a Christian may or may not do when it comes to civil affairs and serving in these capacities. And could he take a human life if he had to while serving as a Christian policeman or in the armed forces? Well, there are questions that we must consider and answer if we're going to arrive at the truth on the subject, or at least satisfy our conscience in that area. Can a Christian bear arms in the armed forces? Can a Christian be a member of Congress? Can a Christian serve as a policeman and protect law-abiding citizens, even to the point of taking a life if it is necessary to protect that one and to enforce the laws of the land, to stand against evildoers when evildoers will not cooperate with the law and have no respect whatsoever for human life? Can he support the legislation of such laws? Can a Christian serve on a jury of a capital murder case, and upon finding the defendant guilty, then he would receive the death penalty? Can a Christian even testify as a witness, and upon his testimony, the evidence presented, then that one would be convicted and put to death? Well, these are questions that we need to keep before us as we study this chapter. But now let's begin this shortest chapter of the book of Romans by looking at verse number 1. Let every soul be in subjection to the higher powers, for there's no power but of God, and the powers that be are ordained of God. Now that's a very important verse, very foundational, and we must come to grips with that as we study this evening. There were Jews during Paul's day that advocated independence from Rome. There were those that certainly wanted to break the yoke of Roman bondage, and they would have a king of their own. And we see that in John 6:15. We also see that there were civil disturbances frequently, and we even realize that on one occasion Claudius demanded in Acts 18:2 that all of the Jews leave Rome. We find that many Christians of Jewish descent were even tempted to align themselves with those that wanted to overthrow the government of that day. And we also find that because of 1 Corinthians 6 and the admonition there to settle differences among brethren without going to courts of law, that there were those who would use this admonition to say then that they did not have to submit to civil authorities at all. In commenting on this, Whiteside said converts from heathenism might feel that, having confessed Jesus Christ as their king, they were not subject to any other government. Hence the special need for Paul's plain and emphatic teaching. To make such submission to earthly government seem more reasonable and necessary, he informs them all, that all power is of God, and that civil governments are ordained of God, he who denies this fact denies the voice of inspiration. Well, it's against this background that the Apostle Paul writes, and he tells us to be in subjection to the higher powers. Now, those higher powers refer to the government of a nation, and every soul, every individual is to be subject to those powers that be. No one is exempt from the powers that be, because the powers that be are ordained of God. This does not mean that the evil rulers and their evil deeds meet with God's blessings and that he approves of them, that he sanctions such. He does not. And we know that those individuals that are like Hero, Stalin, Mussolini, Hitler, they were permitted to rule over countries not because of their high moral standards, not because of their personal goodness, but simply because they were serving in an official capacity of the government. Now, it is the principle of civil authority that is always approved of God and not human beings who would abuse their God-given power in some way. So we need to keep that before us. We find that all power or authority, if you please, is of God, and he is the one that allows governments to exist. And to deny this is simply to deny divine sovereignty. Any government may function within its God-given sphere, but God does not cause any government nor man to do that which is evil. He will not tempt them to do evil. So it's the principle or the authority of government that God is always sanctioning. Now, God has not, nor will he ever, relinquish his divine sovereignty to the devil or anyone else. We know, according to Daniel chapter 2 and verse 21, Jehovah God removeth kings and setteth up kings. We also realize that Christ stated that John would have had, through John, of course, that Pilate would have had absolutely no power against him, except it had been given him from above in chapter 19 and verse 11. And Daniel noted again that the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the lowest of men. And I think we would agree that that has happened in our civilization from time to time. God has always allowed men who are free moral agents to make choices. He does not coerce them, and so they make choices, and we even make choices as we go to the polls, as we vote, and put people in offices of higher powers, and sometimes we do not make the best of choices, do we, as a civilization, and so we pay the price for that, but it's not God's fault. Verse number 2 says, therefore he that resisteth the power withstandeth the ordinance of God, and they that withstand shall receive unto themselves judgment. Now, there's a tremendous truth that's already been pointed out in this lecture several times, but brethren and friends, all men are amenable to the divine word of God. All men. And we need to understand this. Now, Christians especially are to be examples. Because they are Christians, we ought to do our very best, so we have an obligation to respect and to submit to the powers that be, provided they do not conflict with God's divine laws. This is not unique to the book of Romans, this particular concept in Titus chapter 3 and verse number 1. Put them in mind to be in subjection to rulers, authorities, to be obedient. So we are to be in subjection. And speaking by inspiration, Peter said in 1 Peter 2 and 13, be subject to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. Now he goes on to say, whether of the king as supreme or unto governors, as sent to him for vengeance on evildoers, notice that, and for praise to them that do well. This is the will of God. This is as he would have it to be. Now, to resist or is to stand against, defy, and oppose the civil government, and such not should not be done according to the teaching of the Bible. You say, why should not such be done? Simply because the powers that be are ordained of God, and when you resist those powers that be that have been ordained of God, then it's the same as resisting God. And so we find that one has said this, to resist the government does not simply mean to fail, sometimes to obey a law. It is to take a stand against the government. This is what resisting the government would be. To defy the authority of the government. To do this is to raise oneself against both God and the government, and in doing so bring upon himself the judgment of both. Well, is there a limit to our obligation to obey civil authority? Absolutely. Another has phrased it this way. Allegiance to the civil power certainly does not take precedence over allegiance to God. Ordinarily, allegiance to God necessarily involves our respect for and submission to the civil powers. But in the event that the civil powers make a demand of the Christian which is out of harmony with and contrary to God's law, then the principle stated in Acts 5:29 is going to apply. We must obey God rather than men. As long as there is no conflict, The Christian is the best citizen. Even in the event of conflicting demands, Christians will obey God rather than men. We know that this certainly is the truth. Now, other scriptures also testify that our supreme duty is, of course, to do God's will. This is our obligation, to glorify Him, to submit to Him in all that we do. The rulers and elders commanded Christ not to speak at all or teach in the name of Jesus. But it was Peter and John who answered and said, "Whether it's right in the sight of God to hearken unto you or not," he said, "judge ye, for we but cannot speak the things which we both saw and heard," according to Acts 4:18-20. But there's a word of caution even in this area that is in order. The fact that I may think that a law discriminates against me does not authorize me to disobey the law. And this is a quote from one who has studied the matter. The law-abiding spirit means that even though we do not like a particular law, we would continue to obey it as long as it's the law of the land. There's a vast difference, of course, between a law which requires one to do something contrary to the will of God and a law which one thinks restricts his right in some way. This restriction may not be one that involves me in any disobedience to God. Thus, the excuse that we hear today for lawlessness is not upheld by the Scriptures. For the law, which some are violating, are not laws which they must violate in order to obey God, but laws which they have decided to violate in order to get what they think is their right. Oftentimes, these people overlook the fact that they have duties also. Now, verse number 3, if you're following along in chapter 13, says, "Rulers are not a terror to the good work, but to evil. And wouldest thou have no fear of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise from the same." Well, Paul is clearly speaking about those God-given and proper functions of the government, and law-abiding citizens should have nothing to fear if those civil rulers are not abusing their power. But on the other hand, it is clearly taught that those evildoers have every right to be afraid. And so we see that this is God would have it to be. There are governments that fail to function properly, just as there's homes and congregations that fail to function properly. We all understand this principle. Such is not the fault of God. He is not to blame. It doesn't mean it's a bad institution, but it simply means that human beings are not perfect and they do not always make the best choices. Now, there are God-given principles regulating marriage, regulating the church, but just because we see those principles being abused that God would not have abused on every hand all about us does not mean that the institution of marriage as God would have it to be and the church as God would have it to be is wrong, is of no good, because it is indeed good. And so we find that God-given principles are always worthy of the Christian's respect. Verse 4 says, "He is a minister of God to thee for good." Now note this verse very carefully. "But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain." You fear. I do not intend for the government to bear that sword in vain. You be afraid if you are a lawbreaker. Why? He is a minister of God, an avenger of wrath to him that doeth evil. So the intent is of God is for civil rulers to serve citizens in a way that good's going to be accomplished, that peace is going to prevail. This is how He would have it to be. And we find that one who does good should be praised and that one who does evil should be punished. This is how God would have it to be. This is the reason Paul told Timothy in 1 Timothy 2:2, "I exhort you therefore, first of all, that supplications, prayers, you see, be made for all men." He intended us to pray for them, for the kings and all that are in the high place. Well, those who do evil should indeed be afraid, because God does not intend for the powers that be not to bear the sword in vain. He intends for them to indeed bear the sword. And civil powers are serving God and carrying out His will when they execute justice in this way. There is a biblical principle going all the way back to Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, that says, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed." And we see that principle reflected here in Romans chapter 13 and verses 3 and 4. The Apostle Paul fully well realized that the death penalty was indeed valid, and we find that as Paul had to appear before Festus and Caesar's judgment seat, we have this Apostle saying in Acts 25:11, "If I then am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if none of those things are true whereof they accuse me, no man can give me up. To them I appeal unto Caesar, Why did he make a statement such as this? Paul is an apostle. Paul is a member of the Lord's church in the kingdom of heaven. And yet he says that the civil powers have every right to take the life of one who has committed crimes worthy of death. I tell you, I believe that God knew the threat of capital punishment is the only real deterrent to criminal acts. And this is the reason he has enacted the laws that he has enacted. Now, the sixth commandment of the Decalogue is often referred to prove that God did not intend for capital punishment to be enforced. One has said, if the sixth commandment means we cannot put criminals to death, then all the great men of the Bible were fools, and Abraham, Moses, David, Samuel, and all are named because they practiced capital punishment. Someone says, well, that's in the Old Testament. But this writer does not think that Moses and others were fools. He says the command, thou shalt not kill, is a conditional passage, though some are foolish enough to deny this. If the commands, love your enemies, turn the other cheek, put up the sword, resist not him that is evil, are not conditional, then Paul is in trouble, for he used the Roman sword to protect himself. And Paul was an inspired apostle. Another has correctly observed, Romans 13, 1 through 7, follows a section in chapter 12, verses 9 through 21, dealing with admonitions about our private, individual, personal relationships one to another. Paul hastens to explain that his condemnation of individual vengeance and retaliation does not apply to the action of civil ruler in enforcing the law. So you have personal insult and not injury. That's the subject in Romans chapter 12, but the subject changes in Romans chapter 13. God's rulers are accountable, brethren, for inflicting both the divine anger and that of the state upon the evildoer. The same God who said, thou shalt not kill, in Exodus chapter 20, verse 13, also commanded that the man should be surely put to death in Numbers 15, 35. And there is a distinct difference, as has already been pointed out, between murder and killing, and all people need to support and honor God's ministers, servants, who seek to comply with the instructions that he said set forth in his holy writ. Now verse number 5 says, wherefore ye must be needs in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience's sake. So here we find two things mentioned. Divine punishment is going to come upon you if you do not obey the laws of the land. And number 2, you obey the laws of the land and you do not have to be concerned about retaliation from them. And you do not have to be concerned about violating your conscience. So we find that a man who disobeys the laws of his government without having any remorse of conscience whatsoever is one who is lacking in respect for God's commands. Now verse number 6 says, for this cause ye pay tribute also, for they are ministers of God's service, attending continually upon this very thing. For this cause. Well, those who levy taxes, those who collect taxes, are ministers of God's service. And to refuse to pay taxes that have been levied upon land or upon personal property is to rebel against God. And it really doesn't matter, brethren, how you and I may feel about the money or how we may abhor how the money that the government is spending, they're going to be held accountable for that. We may not agree with it. I know we do not agree with everything. God is going to hold the powers that be accountable for serving Him, and He'll hold all citizens accountable for paying their taxes as He has commanded them to do. Both government and God are to be rightfully considered in this matter, and Jesus proves this when He says, render to Caesar's the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's, in Matthew 22 and verse number 21. And the Lord even went so far as to be our example, as He always did, in demonstrating that by commanding Peter to pay the half shekel tax that they owed in Matthew chapter 17, verses 24 through 27. Verse number 7 says, rendered all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. Well, he just simply says that God's servants in positions of authority are to receive what is rightfully theirs, and they are doing His will when they carry these things out that are just, that He intends to be done. Tributes, the tax that might be collected for the civil authorities. Customs may refer to that which is imported or exported from other nations. But God's civil servants, again, are to be feared for their position's sake, for the authority that God has given them. They are operating according to what He would have them to do. Now, the questions that we mentioned at the introduction of this lesson need to be considered. Can Christians serve as civil rulers who administer capital punishment to those who are worthy of such penalty? Can a Christian policeman use deadly force in protecting, responding to a call of a law-abiding citizen when such is necessary. We stated in verse number 2, when we discussed verse number 2, that all men are amenable to the law of Christ, and indeed they are. And this means that both Christians and non-Christians are going to be held accountable for those things which they do. What is sinful for one, brethren, is going to be sinful for another. And it's already been stated that many who reason correctly on the subject of marriage, divorce, and remarriage fail to reason correctly on not bearing the sword in vain. If a Christian does not have God's permission to take the life of a criminal while enforcing the laws of the land, while protecting innocent citizens, neither does the non-Christian have permission. What is sinful for the one is sinful for the other, or else it's going to have to be argued that there are two sets of divine laws, one for the believer and one for the non-believer, and I certainly do not believe this. This will not work. Those who would not hesitate many times to call upon the policeman for protection will insist it's wrong for a Christian to serve in that capacity, but I believe that they have a giant problem in so reasoning. It is simply not morally right to ask, for a Christian to ask a non-Christian to do something that's sinful and wrong. It would be just as wrong for the non-Christian to do it as it would be for the Christian to do it. And when calling for protection, you never know when deadly force might have to be used in order to protect you. Now then, how can God hold one guilty of sin when one is occupying a position of divine authority and doing that which God would have him to do? Well, some accept the truth that there's only one divine system of law, but they would say this, that not even the non-Christian is going to be blameless in bearing the sword against evildoers. And they do this to try to be consistent with their pacifist position. And at least they are consistent in this area, but how in the world can God hold that individual accountable and guilty when he is simply in a position of divine authority and he's bearing the sword as an avenger of wrath against those worthy of such punishment, and this is exactly what God has told him to do? Well, can a Christian serve on a jury of a capital case in order to convict the one who is a murderer? Can a Christian testify against such one in order to obtain a conviction? Surely a person can see that the actions that I'm going to mention now all contribute to one and the same thing. Serving on a jury of a capital case, testifying in that case, and receiving a conviction, a death penalty, are pulling the switch. All have contributed to the outcome. And so do we depend on the non-Christian to come to our rescue in situations when we would want him to come to our assistance and then pronounce him as sinful and wrong because he has to take the life of one to protect us? There surely seems to be a little more than something wrong with such reasoning. And I think the following statement I'm going to make rather succinctly expresses my sentiments in what is a controversial area. I hesitated just a little to use this particular statement, but I do believe it to be the truth. And so it says, it is an intuitively offensive position which holds that heaven has established a situation where sinners defend the property rights and lives of Christians within a society while Christians on the sidelines pray for their success but insist it would be morally wrong for them to bear the same responsibilities personally. Well, the bottom line is, if it's right for evildoers to be punished, it's right for anyone, sinner or Christian, to do the punishing. Paul, I know, said that the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh in 2 Corinthians 10:4. But he was speaking as a member of the Lord's body, a member of the heavenly kingdom. And the Lord's church does not do battle with fleshly weapons. You and I would agree with this. Paul recognized that even though he was a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, he was also a citizen of Rome. And he didn't hesitate then to claim protection as a citizen of the Roman government. And on one occasion, Acts 23 and verse 35, he involved the centurions, the chief captain, and 470 men. 200 of those were spearmen. Now, does it not seem obvious what the spearmen would have done if necessary to protect Paul against a plot against his life? There are those things that a Christian cannot do regarding the church kingdom, but then there are responsibilities God has given one as a citizen of the country that do not infringe upon and really have nothing to do with the church. Well, let's ask another question. Was Peter's sword decorative for protection or just a bluff? Which was it? Peter did not want to see Christ captured, and he didn't really understand as he should have understood, and so he struck out against those who would take Christ prisoner, and Christ said, "Put up again thy sword in its place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword," Matthew 26:52. But this simply shows it's a sword of personal vengeance or personal retaliation that Christ is forbidding. That is condemned. That's consistent with Romans 12:19-21. But there's also a sword of civil law and order that is approved, and that's consistent with Romans 13:3-4. Now, when you study the Scriptures, you realize that there's no one serving in the military who became a Christian and was told to give up his profession. And that has already been alluded to this week. But if one needed to do that in order to be pleasing unto God, then it seems to me that Peter did indeed miss a tremendous opportunity to instruct Cornelius in Acts chapter 10 of such. Neither did anyone speak to the Philippian jailer. Paul did not do such in Acts 16 and tell him that he needed to give up his profession. And so a scripture that is perhaps more convincing in the implication that it makes, that Christians serving as soldiers must simply conduct themselves as God would have them to conduct themselves, is found when they came to John and they wanted to be baptized. They were told in Luke 3:14, "Exhort from no man by violence, neither accuse anyone wrongfully, and be content with your wages." Now, with what wages were they to be content? Well, anyone can see it was the wages of a soldier. That's what they were told. So did not John, a faithful servant, lead the soldiers astray if it was expected of them to give up their profession upon their obedience to the gospel? Well, can an individual protect himself or his family with deadly force? The Bible certainly teaches if anyone will not provide for his own, especially for his own household, he's denied the faith, he's worse than an infidel or an unbeliever in 1 Timothy 5:8. So surely protection from law-defying, law-breaking evildoers is a part of providing for one's family. Such has nothing to do with personal vengeance whatsoever or retaliation. And it's simply appalling to me to think that one would passively sit by and see his family murdered, slain before his very eyes, and try to do nothing about the situation. All I would have to say is that individual better not come to my house uninvited and try that, because that is simply not going to work. I do not believe that God is condemning that. But if Roman soldiers could serve as ministers of God's service in protecting people from lawbreakers, then those in the armed forces could do the same thing today. Are all wars justified? Are all wars to suppress evildoers? I really do not believe that they are. Who is going to decide what war is justified and what war is not justified? Well, ultimately, the individual that's going to be called upon to serve is going to make that decision and then live with his conscience, and he cannot violate his conscience or do that which he deems it to be sinful for him to do. This would be wrong. And brethren, this is the reason that these challenging issues have not caused a break in fellowship in the church of our Lord. The point, I believe, for the child of God to remember is that he is always to refuse the civil authorities when they ask him to do something that is contrary to the will of God, and he must not violate his conscience and do that which he is convicted of is sinful for him to do. Now, verse number 8 is going to change our thinking a little bit and show a Christian's attitude toward all men. You know, as we think about this verse, "Owe no man anything save to love one another, for he that loveth his neighbor hath fulfilled the law." Just a little bit earlier this morning, I ordered two sets of audio tapes and a set of videotapes from Shirley Tuller, and she said, "I'll bill you for these." And I said, "No, I'm going to pay you for them right now." And she said, "That's absolutely fantastic. That is great." So I didn't owe her anything, and she just absolutely loved it. Now, is that what this is talking about here? I do not really think that's the gist of what's going on here. But does this verse teach that it's wrong to purchase items on credit? Well, absolutely not. If you honor the schedule that you've contracted for, then you're not in violation. You do not offend the creditor in any way whatsoever. And when you agree and do pay the monthly amount that you have been scheduled to pay, then certainly everything is due on the given date, and everything is legal and above board, and everyone is happy. Loving one another as God has instructed us to do is a debt that will always be owed and never be paid. Seeking the best spiritual interest of another person is a way of life. One can never say that he's done enough. And this is what the Apostle Paul means when he said, I'm a debtor both to the Greeks and the barbarians, and both to the wise and the foolish. In Romans 1:14, Paul knew he owed a debt he could not pay, and he loved his fellow man deeply and wanted them to be saved. Verse number 9 says, For this, thou shalt not commit adultery, shalt not kill, nor steal, nor covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is summed up in this word, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, the first four commandments, of course, of the Decalogue have to do with one's duties to God. And the last six commandments of the Decalogue have to do with one's duties to his fellow man. And it's the last six commandments now that Paul is concerned about and reminding his brethren of as they contemplate loving their neighbors. You cannot help but remember what the Lord's answer was in Matthew chapter 22, verses 37 through 40, when he said, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and he says, a second is likened unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And then he made the statement that on these two commandments the whole law hangeth and the prophets. Well, loving God with all of his being is certainly something God would have us to do, and that's going to prevent then adultery and murder and stealing and coveting and a whole other list of sins. We could say such like sins. Who is one's neighbor? Well, the American Standard Version in the footnote on verse number 8, the translation has neighbor, but the Greek has the other, and we find that one doesn't have to be really next door to be one's neighbor. And the parable of the Good Samaritan, of course, is going to prove this. You know, the Samaritan, as he had opportunity and as he had means to help, he did help. And then what was Jesus' answer? Jesus said, go thou and do likewise in Luke 10 in verse number 37. Verse number 10 says, love worketh no ill toward his fellow man or toward his neighbor. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law. Paul is simply going to now sum up what he's already emphasized in the previous two verses. If one can love his neighbor, then he's certainly not going to sin against him, and he'll always manifest the proper biblical love toward his neighbor, always have his best spiritual interest at heart. Now, we really need to mark something down in our mind. God has always been concerned with the heart. He's always been concerned with man's attitude. That's not just an Old Testament concept or New Testament concept. God has always been concerned with it. Biblical love is the fulfillment of the law. And Paul certainly taught one could not return to the old Judaistic way of teaching, to the old law in Galatians 5:4 and Ephesians 2:15. But he certainly knew that principles were eternal and that some of them were brought over, of course, for us to do. And he knew that it was never right or a mark of love to commit adultery, to murder, to steal, to covet against your fellow man. Love was not nailed to the cross. It wasn't abolished with the old law. Well, is love all that matters? It simply depends upon what type of love you're talking about. Is it biblical love or is it not biblical love? The liberal teacher, of course, that wants to pervert God's will and his ways and set aside his commands and adulterate the scriptures in the name of love is either ignorant, rebellion, or a bit of both, but he's not going to find any comfort in the Bible at all. And the type of love that we see so often today that is masquerading in the name of biblical love is not all that matters. We need to have a proper understanding of love, biblical love, and we need to do the right things with the right attitude in the right way if we're going to be pleasing unto God. Now, the last section is simply verses 10 through 14. It has to do with holy living as eternity is going to approach. And so we have Paul commenting here about the season. I simply think that he's speaking to these Christians who were spiritually asleep, and many today are spiritually asleep. And Paul is just simply saying you need to wake up because there's going to come a time when life will come to an end. You're not accidentally going to enter into the kingdom of heaven. It's going to take sacrifice, determination, steadfastness, commitment, perseverance on your part. And so you need to get with the task. Verse number 12 says, The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Many explanations have been given. I believe that perhaps Night stands for the Christian's earthly life, which is continually getting shorter, and the day is going to stand for eternity, which is swiftly approaching, and I think this would be in context with everything else that is said on the matter. Verse 13 admonishes us to walk becomingly, as in the day, not reveling in drunkenness, chambering, wantonness, strife, and jealousy. You can see the book to see a definition of these terms, but simply let us say that a Christian is going to diligently strive, agonize over it, put forth a diligent effort to be the proper example, to be becoming in all things, and not lead anyone astray from the precious truth. Verse 14 says, "But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof." Paul is addressing Christians at Rome. "I know you put on Christ in baptism," Galatians 3:27. I think perhaps the term can also be used in another way. Lard made a statement in his commentary that I have in the book. He said it's a metaphor. It's borrowed from the practice of one putting on his clothes. But then at the end of that comment, he said, "You need to be all that Christ requires you to be. Do all that He requires you to do. Beyond this, you cannot go, and short of this, you cannot stop." And I would say amen to that. There are those things that we need to do that are needful for the body, and we need to make provisions for them, but we certainly are not to gratify the lust of the flesh. We must guard against this. Be like Paul in Galatians 2:20. "I've been crucified, no longer I that live, but Christ that liveth in me, and the life that I live in the flesh now, I live in the faith of the Son of God, which who loved me and gave Himself up for me." So we see we have a tremendous task, obligation, responsibility to do those things that a new creature in Christ Jesus would do, not be a stumbling block to anyone else, be a good example to them, not give them any reason whatsoever to turn from Christ. We're to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world, Matthew 5. And this is what He expects of us and what we must do if we're going to have that eternal home. What can we say in summary about this chapter to try to do it justice? Well, all people are to submit to the higher powers because the principle of civil authority is approved of God. The person who opposes the idea of civil government simply opposes God. And a Christian is never required to yield to that which is sinful and wrong, even if government wants him to. We must obey God rather than men. Acts 5 in verse 29. There is only one divine system of law, and every soul is amenable to that divine system. If non-Christians have God's permission to bear not the sword in vain against certain evildoers, then Christians have the same permission. Capital punishment is an eternal principle going past the Mosaical age and all the way back to Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6. Taxes must be paid and honor and respect shown for those in positions of authority, those positions that God has placed His civil servants in. And we even know from 1 Corinthians 13 and chapter 13 and verse 13 that the greatest thing in the world is love. It even exceeds faith and hope. Biblical love is so very, very important, and a Christian must absolutely possess such if he's going to inherit that eternal home. Brethren, may we have the determination, may we have the conviction, the steadfastness and the resolve to live a Christian life, to do those things that are always pleasing to God and those things that will always bring glory and honor to His name. Thank you for your consideration of this challenging chapter this evening.